From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York reflects on his years of faith and activism. Paul Moore was raised in wealth, but later lived and worked among the poor. He gained a reputation as one of the most liberal bishops in the church and was the first bishop to ordain a lesbian priest. He's written a memoir. Also, more stories about Christmas from the author of the Santaland Diaries. David Sedaris reads from his new book, Holidays on Ice. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Gay Metropolis, an oral history of gay life in New York City by Charles Kaiser. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton is set at this hour to name Bill Lan Lee as the Justice Department's top civil rights official. Mr. Clinton is expected to circumvent Senate opposition to the nomination and name Lee acting Assistant Attorney General. That will allow him to serve in the job without Senate confirmation. Congressional Republicans contend that Lee advocates racial quotas in hiring, which are banned by federal law now. Mr. Clinton says, though, that Lee simply advocates affirmative action. The chief United Nations weapons inspector, Richard Butler, says he has made limited progress in his latest round of talks with Iraqi officials. From Baghdad, the BBC's Raghi Omar reports.
Butler said that his two rounds of talks with senior Iraqi officials, including the Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, had yielded little progress. In particular, he said that there had been no resolution of issues relating to two central areas: getting access to presidential palaces and compounds of the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, and getting new information about biological weapons. Butler re-emphasized the point that although the UN had made no specific mention of presidential palaces in any of its documents, Iraq had to accept the principle that UN weapons inspectors had a legal right to visit any building or site which they believed was connected with Iraq's weapons program. However, Baghdad continues to stick to its position that giving weapons inspectors access to presidential palaces would constitute a violation of its national sovereignty and dignity. Raghi Omar, BBC News, Baghdad.
Closing arguments have begun in Terry Nichols' Oklahoma City bombing trial in Denver. Prosecutor Beth Wilkinson says Nichols was a full partner in the bombing. She says Nichols intended death, destruction, and chaos. A consumer group is accusing hundreds of hospitals of illegally dumping untreated patients from their emergency rooms. NPR's Greg Peppers has details.
Public Citizen says nearly 700 hospitals have denied treatment to patients in their emergency rooms in the last 10 years. But the group adds that only a small number of facilities have been fined. The consumer group is accusing the hospitals of breaking a 1986 law and the Department of Health and Human Services of failing to enforce it. A Public Citizen report contends that since the law took effect, the government has confirmed violations at 692 hospitals, but only 67 facilities have been fined or dropped from the Medicare program. A spokesman for the American Hospital Association says hospitals are doing their best to care for the uninsured. An HHS spokeswoman says the department is handling an increasing number of cases. She notes that many complaints have yet to be resolved and may still result in fines. Greg Peppers, NPR News, Washington.
The federal government has taken the first steps today toward setting uniform standards for organic foods, but the Agriculture Department sidesteps such controversial issues as whether genetically altered crops can qualify as organic. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 40 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed in early trading today. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
Investors have taken encouragement from an overnight rally in the South Korean stock market. The benchmark index rose 7% when South Korea's presidential candidates pledged to make difficult reforms required to receive financial aid from the International Monetary Fund. At the same time, transportation issues are higher after UAL Corp., the parent of United Airlines, said fourth quarter earnings will meet or exceed expectations. However, computer-related issues are in broad decline after several analysts lowered earnings expectations for a number of leading technology companies. I'm Doug Krisner.
A surge in manufacturing activity last month pushed industrial production up 0.8%. That's the biggest gain since July. Factories are now operating at their highest rate of capacity in more than 2 years. Analysts say, though, they see no inflationary bottlenecks in production ahead because sagging economies in Asia and elsewhere still have excess manufacturing capacity. Leaders of the Southeast Asian nations meeting in Malaysia are appealing to the world's superpowers to do more to help shore up that region's shaky economies. President of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos, said the Asian financial crisis is bound to get worse before it gets better. Some of the Southeast Asian currencies have lost more than 40% of their value since July. Trade regulators have given tentative approval to the $36 billion merger of British beer maker Guinness and Grand Met, which owns Burger King. The action came after the two companies agreed to divest themselves of three top-selling liquor brands. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, led his church in the direction of social change. He advocated the ordination of women and was the first bishop to ordain an out-of-the-closet lesbian. He fought for civil rights and opposed the war in Vietnam. He began his work leading a parish in an inner-city neighborhood in New Jersey. As a former teacher of his once said, Moore was the first Episcopal priest to widen the understanding of the Christian mission from narrow concepts of overseas work or work in rural areas into an organized and structured ministry to the poor, the minorities, and other neglected people of the inner city. Moore gave his last sermon as bishop in 1989. Now he's written an autobiography called Presences. Although he's devoted much of his life to working with the poor, he grew up in wealth, in a house in New Jersey staffed by butlers and maids with a three-hole golf course just beyond the garden. He writes that he never renounced his wealth. I asked if he was always conflicted over whether to keep his money or give it away.
My first wife and I worried about this, especially when we were living in Jersey City amongst many poor people who didn't have enough clothes and sometimes not enough to eat, and I could have written them a check for $100. But that would have been a very bad thing for the dynamics of the work we were doing. But what we decided to do was to live in a relatively modest fashion in Jersey City. We lived right there next to the church, very modestly. And then to give away whatever of our income was left after we spent what we needed to spend to charity of one kind or another. And then later on, I took a big hunk of it and made a foundation, which I could use anonymously to help other causes. And over the years, I've given away a lot of the capital as well as the income, but not to the point of St. Francis. I did not strip down in the public square, and I still wear clothes.
Now, you said before that you could have written out a check to poor people for, you know, $100 to help them out, but that would have been bad for the dynamics of what you were trying to do. I want you to elaborate on that.
Well, that would have meant that they would be coming there for a handout, period, and we probably would have had 1,000 people at the door. And just giving out checks, that was not what we were about. But that had to do with the church and parish being the center of a community of love, God's love, human love, starting at the altar where we had our Eucharist each day and spreading out into the community in terms of ministering to poor people in their hardship, but also in trying to change the system and developing a network through the city as best we could by establishing cell groups in different neighborhoods, by getting to know the children and through them their parents, by encouraging rent strikes and so forth. Doing this in order to try to change the system. And if we had become just a handout place, first of all, we would have eventually had to set up guidelines and become just sort of a second-rate foundation, and that was not what we were there for. So my extra money that we had, I gave outside the parish to other causes within the church and in the world.
You said that religion wasn't an important part of your life until about the 11th grade. What religion were you born into?
Episcopal Church. My mother was a Presbyterian, actually, but she went to the Episcopal Church because my father went there. Then he quit, she continued. But she used to take me to church every Sunday. I didn't go to Sunday school. First time I went, they threw spitballs at me because I didn't know the kids. So I never went back. And I kept going every Sunday. It was very boring. And I used to look at the stained glass windows and fiddle with the prayer books. Went to St. Paul's School. It was still pretty boring, but a little nicer because there was an atmosphere of a school there and the prayers were more youth-friendly.
Well, part of what changed you was your first confession.
That's right.
What made you decide to take this first, to give this first confession?
Well, there was a master on the faculty there who was a priest, and we were a so-called low church school. However, he was very interested in what we used to call Anglo-Catholicism, which was the high church or Catholic part of our Episcopal heritage. And the Anglo-Catholic churches had incense, they had bells, people crossed themselves, people genuflected. It was a whole other thing. It was Catholicism. And he used to take us to high church ceremonies, which were rather mysterious and wonderful and beautiful. And as adolescents, we were drawn to that. And also the fact, he said, don't tell the rector of the school I took you because he wouldn't approve. So there was sort of sub rosa, which is also for a teenager very interesting. And then he talked about confession, which was always available in our church, but very little used, and encouraged us to do that. And we were a little scared of the idea. So a monk came to school, and I was asked to go see him, which I did, and talk to him about why should I confess to a man when I could confess directly to God. And he said, well, of course you can confess to God directly, but when you make your confession, it's a sacrament. It's a deeper kind of assurance of forgiveness. So looking back was sort of funny, but at the time was very embarrassing, naturally, and I made my confession to him later that night with clammy hands and shaking fingers. And when he pronounced the absolution, as a priest, I absolve you from all your sins in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, I was overwhelmed by a presence of God, by a sense of peace and joy and wonder. I can't describe it. And walked home to my room in the clouds and made my communion the next day, and it was as if I'd received the sacrament for the first time. And that was a turning point in my life.
And did you stay with the Anglican Church?
Oh, yes.
After that? Bishop Paul Moore is my guest, and he's written a memoir called Presences. You know, you became a Marine and fought in World War II shortly after your conversion experience, and your conversion experience transformed you, but I'm sure the war did too. Did you feel at all like it was changing you in a different direction, away from the like open-heartedness that you wanted to have as a convert, as a new convert?
Well, yes and no. I think first of all, I had some questions about whether a Christian should go to war. But my rector had been in World War I, had been gassed. He was a wonderful and very devout man. I respected him enormously. And he felt, as I did then, that it was the lesser of two evils, that Hitler and, because the Japan wasn't in it then, but Nazism, if that took over the world, beginning with Europe, that it would be a total disaster for the church and for civilization, and that this is one of the few times where it was justified to fight, a just war, if you will. So I went in, and once I decided to go in, I gobbled up the Marine Corps hook, line, and sinker, Semper Fidelis, rough, tough, leatherneck. We had bayonet training where we had to scream and yell and stick our bayonets into straw dummies and knock heads off dummies, heads that were dressed up to look like Japanese oriental heads. It was absolutely terrible. But this process was a toughening up of our psyche. I was a young, callow kid from Yale. I had to be toughened to go through the stuff we would go through. And so the training was necessary. But it made us impervious to some of the horrors that we were asked to do. I shot one man I know without any need to have shot him just because he was lying there, and I just shot him. And this happened again and again and again. But so we had to have been toughened. But at the same time, it did make me realize that my faith was strong enough to get me through that kind of horror and come out on the other side.
You were hit by a grenade during the war, and it punctured a lung.
Actually, I was throwing a
It was your own grenade that blew up.
I threw a grenade at a machine gun nest, which was killing some of our men. And as I knelt up right to throw it, I got hit by the machine gun I was throwing the grenade at. So I was hit by a bullet, went through my chest, past my heart. The doctors thought it should have hit the heart, but they figured the heart was on the inbeat when the bullet went by. So I was very lucky, to put it mildly.
But at the time, you thought you were dying, and you write
that... At the time,
that,
I thought I was dying.
And you write that this near-death experience wasn't a spiritual experience at all. What were you expecting, and how did it compare?
Well, I wasn't expecting anything. I hadn't really thought much about it. Death was all around us. We were getting quite casual about death. I remember running out under fire to get a package of cigarettes. I risked my life to get a package of cigarettes. My friends had been killed. My man I'd seen bleeding in my arms. And death became so common. It's hard to believe that when I finally got hit, so I got hit this time, and I lay down after this bullet went in. The wind was going in and out of, blubbering in and out of this wound in my lung, and I thought I was dying. I gave over the platoon to the sergeant, and then I fainted. But before I fainted, I thought, well, I'm supposed to remember my whole life. That didn't happen. Then I said, oh, I better say a prayer, which I said a prayer commending myself to God. But it wasn't a deep business of seeing Jesus coming to get me or anything like that. It was sort of almost casual. Now, if I had died, I don't know whether it would have been that casual or whether it would have been a much deeper experience. I presume it would have been. But if I died going back to the aid station on that stretcher when I was already unconscious, what I just recounted would have been my experience of death, at least the conscious part of dying. And whether something else opens up after you lose consciousness, if you are dying, is one of the great mysteries.
My guest is Bishop Paul Moore. His new autobiography is called Presences. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Paul Moore, former Episcopal Bishop of New York. Because you're a bishop in the Anglican Church and not the Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. you were able to marry and have children. Celibacy is not required of priests in the Anglican Church. Do you think you could have been a celibate priest, or is that something? Do you disagree with the concept that you need to?
I disagree totally with that concept. Mm-hmm. There are some priests who are drawn to the celibate life. We have celibates in our church. We have monks who are celibate by vow, and we have secular priests who have not gotten married for whatever reason and are celibate. But that wasn't for me. I mean, I wanted to have children. I'd fallen in love before I went to the seminary. I was married before I became a priest. And I feel very deeply that my marriage and experience in my family, not only the joys of it, but some of the pain and sorrow of family life gave me, and the difficulty of marriage gave me an understanding in counseling people who were having marital problems and family problems that I never could have had as a single priest. And this isn't putting down celibacy for those who want it. But I feel I think one reason the Roman Church today has so few priests, they're really in a real difficult situation, is because they won't break that celibacy rule.
You were a father during those difficult-to-be-a-parent times of the 1960s.
The 60s.
I think some of your children were teenagers during the 60s.
Indeed, they were.
All the sexual standards of the past were being challenged by young people. And you write in your book that you wanted to give your children as much freedom as possible, although you forbade drugs with whatever power you had to do that. But that, you know, you believe the culture suffered from too much sexual puritanism. So when your children were coming of age, how did you deal with issues of their sexuality and of how they could deal with boyfriends and girlfriends in the house?
Well, that was tough. I mean, we started by being very much against anybody having intercourse until they were married. And then the next step is, as we were exposed to the liberal thinking of the 60s, which you just described, we began to think this was a little bit too tight. And my wife would teach my teenage daughters about birth control so that if they did have intercourse, they would be safe. This is long before AIDS, of course. Right. As far as the dope goes, we are vigorously against hard drugs of any kind, but we were a little loose about marijuana. I remember going upstairs, my 15-year-old was suddenly interested in growing plants in a window box. And I thought, isn't this nice? And I looked up, and of course, the plants were marijuana.
Right.
So we went through that kind of thing. But right. You just struggle through. We were making ad hoc decisions in the midst of the event. We didn't have a hard ideology we insisted on, and I'm sort of glad we didn't. I think, looking back, I think we did okay. I might have made some changes in retrospect.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bishop Paul Moore, who is the former Episcopal Bishop of New York. He's written a memoir called Presences. You supported the ordination of women in your church, and you were the first bishop to ordain a lesbian priest within the church. How did you come around to that thinking? You didn't always support the ordination of women or gays.
Well, I think one of the reasons I came around so quickly to the ordination of women is I had six daughters and a wife.
Were they pushing you?
Indeed, they were. I remember one time when we were up in the Adirondack, I said, "Girls, why don't you clear the table?" "Girls? Why should the girls clear the table?" So, you know, that taught me one lesson.
All right.
And, well, the whole ethos of the women's movement was very much part of their thinking and my wife's thinking and my thinking, and it wasn't long before I realized it was just absolutely ridiculous not to allow women to be priests. Historically, although theology says that God is beyond gender, neither man nor woman, historically God has been looked at as a father figure, as a male figure, as a God of judgment. And I think the Roman Catholic Church has sort of made up for that by their cult of the Virgin. But in our church, the Virgin Mary didn't have much of a role. And therefore, I think our people were starved for a femininity in their devotion. And so when women became priests and you could hear a woman's voice reading the Bible, a woman's voice celebrating the Eucharist, you gradually realized that Jesus Christ took on human flesh, happened to be a man, but he took on all human flesh, and that God made us in his image, both man and woman, and that's in the Bible. But that was a very deep reason to have women priests, as well as the obvious reason of its being discriminatory not to.
What about gays and lesbians?
Gays and lesbians, again, what happened to me was that a gay woman who was out of the closet, as it were, she'd written articles for a gay magazine, came to see me, wanted to be a priest. She's totally qualified, brilliant academically, and a fine person. But she was out of the closet. And I said, no way could we ordain you. And the standing committee, who had to okay too, I wouldn't even think of it. I floated by them. They said half of them would resign if I did this. So I said, no. She said, well, I'm going to go to seminary anyway. I said, well, feel free. So she came back 3 years later and asked again. By that time, a lot had happened. Women were beginning to be ordained. And so it was possible. And I thought to myself, over those 3 years, the only difference between Ellen Barrett, her name, and maybe 20% of our clergy who were gay and in the closet is she is more open, more honest. Not that they didn't have a right to be private, but she also had a right, it seemed to me, to be open. So I headed one of my chapters, my last book about this issue, is honesty a bar to ordination? And I couldn't answer yes. So I said, okay, Ellen, we'll try it. The standing committee reluctantly went along. We ordained Ellen and all hell broke loose. Later on, some of the parishes refused to pay their dues to the diocese. I had hearings when I was repudiated. It was all over the papers. I had special secretary to answer the mail, and I finally, there was an attempt to censure me in the House of Bishops. So it was an enormous explosion. People say, you're so courageous. I said, it's like being courageous to say you're courageous when you're standing in the middle of the road and get hit by a truck.
Any regrets?
No, but I'm not sure I would have been as courageous as I was if I'd known what was going to happen. I hope I would have been.
Since we have Christmas coming up, I'd like to take you back to 1949, which was your first Christmas as an ordained priest. In fact, I think it was your first Eucharist.
You're right.
Would you share some of your memories of that first Eucharist in 1949?
Well, it was in Jersey City, and it was a wonderful moment for me. The congregation was already integrated. A lot of the boys we'd begun to reach had become acolytes. And to be able to stand at the altar, especially in that inner-city situation, and realize you were celebrating the Eucharist for Christmas when our Lord became a poor child and changed, redeemed the whole life of human beings by that becoming man, becoming human. And the other thing that was so strange was that Christmas was a very cruel time for many of our people because they couldn't afford to buy presents for their children. We had attempted suicides. We had murders. We had alcoholism. Whenever Christmas came, it was a time of horror stories as well as a time of beauty. And so I've always remembered that. And if only people understood, especially poor people understood, that the message of Christmas was that God became poor, then perhaps they wouldn't have this awful tension between the materialistic Christmas and advertisements and the little they're able to do to their own families. So there was always this tension, as there was in the original Christmas, a homeless woman having an illegitimate child in a stable. And our image of all the lovely carols and golden Christmases that we have.
Paul Moore is the former Episcopal Bishop of New York. He's written an autobiography called Presences. Well, comic actor and singer Stubby Kaye has died at the age of 79 of lung cancer. He had an ebullient voice, which was put to great use in the Broadway musical Lil Abner and the Broadway and movie versions of Guys and Dolls. In 1988, he did the voice of Marvin Acme in the animated movie Who Killed Roger Rabbit. We'll close this half hour with Stubby Kaye singing Sit Down Your Rock in the Boat from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I dreamed last night I got on the boat to heaven, and by some chance I had brought my dice along. And there I stood, and I hollered, someone fade me. But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance found a bottle in my fist. And there I stood nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, beware, you're on a heavenly trip. People all said, beware, beware, you scuttle a ship. And the devil will drag you under by the fancy tie round your wicked throat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And as I laughed at those passengers to heaven.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer and former Santaland elf David Sedaris talks with us about Christmas and his family and reads from his new collection of Christmas stories, Holidays on Ice. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Gay Metropolis, a new history of gay life in New York City. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On television, the Christmas season means it's time for It's a Wonderful Life, A Christmas Carol, and Miracle on 34th Street. But on public radio, it means time for the Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris' funny and cynical journal of the season he worked as an elf in Macy's Santaland. The Santaland Diaries are included in a new collection of Sedaris' Christmas-related stories called Holidays on Ice. Sedaris' stories and journal entries have been heard on Morning Edition and on This American Life. Several of his plays have been produced in New York. We invited him to talk with us about Christmas in his family and to read an excerpt of one of his Christmas stories. This story shows what might happen if a tough-minded drama critic reviewed Christmas plays staged by elementary school kids.
Front row center with Thaddeus Bristol. Trite Christmas. Scottsfield's young hams offer the blandest of holiday fare. The approach of Christmas signifies three things: bad movies, unforgivable television, and even worse, theater. I'm talking bone-crushing theater, the type our ancient ancestors used to oppress their enemies before the invention of the stretching rack. We're talking torture on a par with the Scottsfield Dinner Theater's 1994 revival of Come Blow Your Horn, a production that violated every tenet of the Human Rights Accord. To those of you who enjoy the comfort of a nice set of thumbscrews, allow me to recommend any of the crucifying holiday plays and pageants currently eliciting screams of mercy from within the confines of our local elementary and middle schools. I will, no doubt, be taken to task for criticizing the work of children, but as any pathologist will agree, if there's a cancer, it's best to treat it as soon as possible. Once again, the sadists at the Jane Snow Hernandez Middle School have taken up their burning pokers in an attempt to prod A Christmas Carol into some form of submission. I might have overlooked the shoddy production values and dry, leaden pacing, but these are sixth graders we're talking about, and they should have known better. There's really no point in adapting this Dickensian stinker unless you're capable of looking beyond the novel's dime store morality and getting to what little theatrical meat the story has to offer. The point is to eviscerate the gooey center, but here it's served up as an entree, and a foul pudding it is. Most of the blame goes to the director, 11-year-old Becky Michaels, who seems to have picked up her staging secrets from the school's crossing guard. She tends to clump her actors, moving them only in groups of five or more. A strong proponent of trendy, racially mixed casting, Michaels gives us a black Tiny Tim, leaving the audience to wonder, what, is this kid supposed to be adopted? It's a distracting move, wrong-headed and pointless. The role was played by young Lamar Williams, who, if nothing else, managed to sustain a decent limp. The program notes that he had recently lost his right foot to diabetes, but was that reason enough to cast him? As Tiny Tim, the boy spends his stage time essentially trawling for sympathy, stealing focus from even the brightly lit exit sign. Bob Cratchit, played here by the aptly named Benjamin Trite, seems to have picked up his Cockney accent by watching a few videotaped episodes of Hee Haw, and Herschel Fleischman's Scrooge was almost as lame as Tiny Tim. The set was not without its charm, but Jody Lennon's abysmal costumes should hopefully mark the end of a short and unremarkable career. I was gagging from the smell of spray-painted sneakers, and if I see one more top hat made from an oatmeal canister, I swear to God I'm going to pull out a gun. The problem with all these shows stems partially from their maddening eagerness to please. With smiles stretched tight as bungee cords, these hopeless amateurs pranced and gambled across our local stages, hiding behind their youth and begging, practically demanding we forgive their egregious mistakes. The English language was chewed into a paste, missed opportunities came and went, and the sets were changed so slowly you'd think the stagehands were encumbered by full-body casts. While billing themselves as holiday entertainment, none of these productions came close to capturing the true spirit of Christmas. This glaring irony seemed to escape the throngs of ticket holders who ate these undercooked turkeys right down to the bone. Here were audiences that chuckled at every technical snafu and applauded riotously each time a new character wandered out onto the stage. With the close of every curtain, they leapt to their feet in one ovation after another, leaving me wedged into my doll-sized chair and wondering, is it just them or am I missing something?
David Sedaris reading an excerpt of one of his stories from his new collection, Holidays on Ice. Thanks for reading that, David. I'm wondering what made you think about a theater critic who goes to sixth grade school productions and applies his astringent facilities on these sixth graders.
I was in France when I was writing these stories, and I had a stack of old New York magazines there. And John Simon is a theater critic for New York Magazine. And I may have missed it, but to my knowledge, he has never liked anything. So I was just thinking that what if a person like him was assigned to review children's theater? Because if you were a child, if you're 7 years old, what do you do with this review?
Oh, really? Did you participate in school Christmas plays when you were a kid?
I didn't go to, I went to a public school. I think if I had gone to a Christian school, I probably would have snagged the part of a donkey or a shepherd or something. But no, I was never, our school would have a pageant every year. Just a very simple thing, but it was mainly the students would dress up and get on stage, and then they would pull out all the janitors. And the janitors would receive dented cans of fruit cocktail or cans of Crisco. And then the janitors would bow their heads and thank us for it, and that was the pageant.
Wow. your most famous story, The Santaland Diaries, is collected in this new Christmas collection, Holidays on Ice. And I'm wondering if you've ever gone back to Macy's Santaland, where you once worked as a Christmas elf, just as an observer to see what it's like now.
No, but I got a call last week from a former Santa, because Macy's changed their Santaland this year. They spent millions of dollars, and my understanding is that now it's like an interactive Santaland.
Like with computers and stuff?
Yeah, the children were having riots. You know, they were waiting for 2 hours to see Santa, and all they saw were some elves and a couple of candy canes, and that wasn't enough for them, so they've spent a lot of money, and I just read an article about it in the newspaper, but apparently there's, I don't know, virtual, because I don't have a computer, I don't even know exactly what these words mean, but something about it is virtual.
You don't have a computer?
And maybe you can send Santa email, I don't know. No, I've never touched one. So whenever I hear words like .org, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Do you hear from a lot of current and former Santaland elves who want to commiserate with you?
I hear from former elves and Santas who have written screenplays. Those are the former elves and Santas that I tend to hear from.
My guest is David Sedaris, and he has a new collection of Christmas-related stories called Holidays on Ice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Sedaris. Now, I want to talk to you more about what Christmas is like for you and what it's been like for you. What was Christmas like in your family when you were growing up? Did your family celebrate it or give gifts?
Oh, we were very involved in Christmas. I mean, we still are. You know, Christmas begins the day after Halloween, basically, and then everything is just this march towards Christmas. And, oh, we're big gift givers. And I love Christmas. Absolutely love it.
What went on in your house on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day?
Well, when we were children, we had to go to church on Christmas Eve, but it was a Greek Orthodox church, and so it was pretty, and they were, you know, still you just wanted to get out of there, but it didn't take that long. And we would usually be up all night, you know, wrapping gifts or... By the time we were a teenage, by the time we were old enough to smoke pot, we were definitely awake all night. And, but not with that, oh, I think I hear Santa thing. That's like, I think I hear Dad coming downstairs, throw the roach out the window kind of thing. But no, we were really, gosh, I'm, I mean, my mom always my mom was kind of in charge of, my mother was responsible for making Christmas so wonderful. You know, just doing mom things. You know, baking mom things and buying mom kind of gifts and putting, you know, wreaths on the door that we would just make fun of, but still we were glad that they were there.
What are some of the best gifts you ever got?
I got an electric typewriter, which really changed my life. I'd been using a manual typewriter forever. And then at the age of 32, my mother gave me an electric typewriter where you could correct things. You know, you could go up two lines and that word would be gone. And that was a present that really changed my life. Last year, I got a really nice taxidermied ostrich, a little baby ostrich. That was a nice gift.
Who gave that to you?
My sister Gretchen gave me a stuffed ostrich. It is just adorable. It's about a foot tall. I got a lot of taxidermy last year for Christmas, and that's always a good gift. Gosh, you know, I mean, I've never received, like, the title to a country home or anything like that. It's
maybe next year. But do you remember the worst gift you ever got?
The worst gift I ever got was probably a football helmet, which I had absolutely no use for whatsoever.
I can only
imagine.
That's
not even good for storing things.
Who gave it to you?
My father.
Was that wishful thinking on his part?
He went through a phase where all of the gifts that he gave me would hopefully wake me up to the world of sports. So maybe I would have asked for a discreet, you know, portable tape recorder so I could spy on people, and instead I would get a child-sized set of golf clubs, which the cat was the only person who would enjoy them. She would just shred the golf bag to bits, but she was more than welcome to them.
And what about you as a gift giver? Are you a careful and thoughtful gift giver?
I think I am. I always feel so bad. You know, when people say, well, I'm going to do my shopping on Christmas Eve, I feel bad for the people that they're giving gifts to, because you're not going to find anything on Christmas Eve. That kind of panic buying that people do,
mm-hmm.
I love watching it, and I'll still go to the store on Christmas Eve just so I can see people that panic.
But do you really do that?
Yes. I love, like, the same way I love going to the grocery store the night before Thanksgiving, and I'll just buy a head of lettuce, but I'm more than happy to stand in that line for 45 minutes just to see people at the breaking point. But I have a few things to buy, but for the most part, I finished my shopping by August.
Really? So you must always be thinking about potential gifts for people.
Well, I don't think about it in February, but I think about it by March.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to shop, and this gives me a reason to do so.
Did you ever go caroling during your life?
No, carolers are one of those things that even my mother would be like, don't answer the door, don't answer the door. They're at the Shirk's house, or they're coming this way. Turn out the lights, hide. Because I don't know how you respond. Do you know what I mean? Like when you open the door and then there's people there singing and they're looking at you. It's like you just give them the money now and maybe they'll go away or maybe they'll stop. Caroling is what, it's like mime to me. It's just one of those things where I don't know what choice the spectator really has. It's just so uncomfortable.
You live in Manhattan now. There probably aren't a lot of people out caroling in Manhattan.
Well, I don't have to worry about them coming to the door in my apartment. Someone would have to buzz them in. And so I don't worry about them coming to my door. And that's a good thing about living in a city.
You know, when you're young, you spend Christmas the way your parents spend it. When you get older, you have the option of, you know, maybe doing it with friends or whatever. You're not necessarily home with your family. Do you remember, like, the first Christmas that you were old enough to decide for yourself how you were going to spend it?
I'm 40 years old, and I've never missed a Christmas at home.
Really?
Never.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't really expect good presents unless you're going to show up and get them in person. And if somebody thinks that they can mail you something, then you're liable to get anything. You're liable to get a pound cake or something like that. But if they know that they have to face you and hand you a gift, then you're much better off by going home. I can't, There's no other place I would want to be for Christmas, really, than with my brothers and sisters.
Do you do New Year's resolutions? Did you ever?
No, not really. You know, when I turned 40, I made resolutions, but I don't really do them with New Year's because I know it's just a waste of time for me personally. It's just such an arbitrary, I mean, New Year's Eve, it you know, I suppose it's supposed to be this rebirth and all that stuff, but just doesn't cut it for me. It's just a new calendar.
So what resolutions did you have when you turned 40?
I threw away all my jeans, and I resolved never to wear jeans again or eat any kind of a dip.
Why'd you throw away your jeans?
Because I felt like I turned 40 and I should give up a couple of things, but I didn't want to give up anything that was important to me. And jeans, I could easily, I don't know, I never looked very good in jeans. I just thought, well, that's it. I'm never going to wear jeans again. And dip, I don't eat dip that much anyway, so I thought, well, this would be a good thing to get rid of. But I didn't want to, you know, like I don't want to stop smoking or drinking or stop taking drugs or I don't want to stop doing anything I really enjoy, so I just chose a few arbitrary things.
Well, I'm sure that really made you a better human being. So do you ever really yearn for jeans now?
I yearn for dip more than I yearn for jeans. That's why I can't go to holiday parties, because I might be forced to break my resolution and eat some dip.
David, I would like to end our Christmas interview with by asking you to sing a rendition of one of your favorite Christmas songs, a song that is a favorite because you particularly love it or hate it.
Well, somebody sends us a tape every year of different obscure Christmas songs that he puts together. And there's one, and I don't quite have all the words, but it's like a really obnoxious child with a full voice, almost like a young Wayne Newton voice. and it's, I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do. Don't want a dinky, I want a hippopotamus to play with and enjoy. I can see it now on Christmas morning creeping down the stairs. Oh, what joy and what surprise when I open up my eyes and see a hippo hero standing there. I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. And then he restates again and again reasons why he wants a hippopotamus. And the fact that the hippopotamus will most likely be a vegetarian. That's the gist of the song. But I can listen to it over and over and over again. It's just so confident. And it's not a, and it's not like a wacky song. You know, like not like when they have babies crying out Silent Night or dogs barking it or something. It's really just a wonderful little song. And I don't even know the fellow's name who sang it.
Well, I want to thank you for singing it for us. And I also want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You too.
Well, David Sedaris has a new collection of Christmas-related stories called Holidays on Ice. It includes the Santaland Diaries. Sedaris and others will do readings of his Christmas stories on the Christmas Week edition of the public radio program This American Life. Well, lots of new Christmas records have come out this year. Even RuPaul has one.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me.
That's right, baby.
I've been an awful good queen.
Very good.
Santa baby, hurry down the chimney tonight.
Santa baby, you better run. Run, don't walk, honey. Oh, and don't forget the ring cash.
Santa baby,
vehicle.
I wait up for you, dear Santa baby.
Oh,
so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Santa, don't get
yes, tonight.
You was crazy as hell when you came here, but you in your right damn mind now.
Christmas list.
Tell it like it is, girl.
Oh, Santa baby.
Honey, listen.
I want a yacht and really that's not.
That ain't asking a lot. No,
I've been an angel all year.
I put a lot of miles on my vehicle.
Hurry down and the I chimney tonight.
TP, the total package.
Tonight.
TP, honey, the total package. You hear me? Tonight. Say, baby, listen here. Don't forget to bring the cash.
Santa, honey.
I'm not rich, honey.
One little thing I really need.
But if I have the dollars, cash money.
To a platinum mine.
Oh, yes, honey.
Santa, baby.
Listen here.
Coming up, a review of a new history of gay life in New York City. This is Fresh Air. Charles Kaiser is a former reporter who wrote for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. For his new book, The Gay Metropolis, Kaiser used his interviewing skills to construct a sweeping oral history of gay life in New York City over the past 50 years. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Charles Kaiser's new book, The Gay Metropolis, is the kind of vast, entertaining, and inspiring work of oral history that you'd expect a Studs Terkel to write, if Studs Terkel were gay. I feel safe, by the way, in assuming that Studs is straight, because he's not mentioned in The Gay Metropolis, a book that seems to give voice to almost every gay man, great and small, revered and reviled, who made an impact on queer life in the latter half of the 20th century. Gore Vidal, Roy Cohn, and Moss Hart, who knew, rub shoulders with the semi-anonymous likes of Otis Bigelow, hailed by his many male admirers as the best-looking man in Manhattan in the 1940s. We readers are treated to gossipy anecdotes about bacchanalian gay nightlife in the 1970s, including a very funny story about Bob Dylan manipulating the language of gay liberation in order to talk his way into a gay club just to use the men's room. We're also humbled by the acts of courage Kaiser recounts, such as Truman Capote's lonely bravado in publicly denouncing J. Edgar Hoover as a killer fruit. The gay metropolis itself is gay in both senses of the word. Not only does it build on other respected works of gay history, like Coming Out Under Fire by Alan Berube and Gay New York by George Chauncey, but it does so in an often effervescent, even cheeky style. Imagine taking a college-level social studies seminar taught by Paul Rudnick, and you'll get an idea of the book's tone. Kaiser mostly focuses on gay male life in New York City, the literal gay metropolis of the modern world. His history begins in the 1940s, when many bars in New York displayed signs that read, "If you are gay, please stay away." During World War II, Kaiser says, the United States Army acted as a great, secret, unwitting agent of gay liberation by creating the largest concentration of homosexuals within a single institution in American history. As he does throughout the book, Kaiser effectively dramatizes the impact of large-scale historical events through personal accounts. One of the most colorful testimonies in this section is that offered by Leo Altman, a young and, of course, closeted army captain who recalls discovering his first gay nightclub in Paris. "You walked in," he says, "and suddenly you realized the size of homosexuality. There were free Poles dancing with American soldiers. There were Scotsmen dancing with Algerians. I mean, there were men dancing with each other. I had never seen that before in my life. For me, it was sort of like a VE Day for gays, before the real VE Day. In general, the chapters of the Gay Metropolis that cover the 1940s through the 1960s are richer than its later sections on AIDS and gay legislation, primarily because the earlier material is less familiar and more shocking. In this, Ellen's much-heralded coming-out year, Kaiser performs a cautionary service by reminding his readers that only a few short decades ago, homosexuality was uniformly diagnosed by psychiatrists as a sickness. The mention of lesbians and gays in the newspapers was always in connection with crime, and women in New York City were legally required to wear at least one article of women's clothing whenever they appeared in public. As Kaiser and his interviewees vividly detail, World War II, the Kinsey Report, the pill, Broadway shows like The Boys and the Band, and most thrillingly of all, the Stonewall Riot, transformed the way society and gay men themselves understood their lives. Kaiser compares Stonewall's impact to the effect of the Six-Day War on Jews around the world. For the first time, he says, thousands of members of each tribe finally thought of themselves as warriors. Kaiser himself is a happy warrior in the ongoing struggle to redeem the promise of America, wielding his pen with an exuberance and outrageousness that would make Whitman smile.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Gay Metropolis by Charles Kaiser. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sarah Scherr. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.